Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the internet wars going on between the United States and North Korea following the hacking of Sony by North Korea that the president described as cyber vandalism while vowing to retaliate with a proportional response. We'll examine the ethical issues involved with military cyber attacks on civilian targets, and since so far cyber attacks have been bloodless without the loss of life, we will assess how this new form of warfare fits into the current definitions and laws of war. Fritz Ohlhoff, a professor in the Department of Philosophy at Western Michigan University and author of Binary Bullets, The Ethics of Cyber Warfare, joins us to discuss this largely hidden new military frontier, while on the civilian front, tens of thousands of cyber attacks happen every day. Then we'll examine the new report from the Committee to Protect Journalists that finds that international journalists were killed at a higher rate in 2014, with the Middle East the most dangerous region. Carlos Loria, the Senior Americas Program Coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists, joins us to discuss the new CPJ annual report that documents that almost half of the journalists killed in 2014 died in the Middle East, while more than 40% of journalists killed were targeted for murder, with 31% reporting that they received prior death threats. We will also look at the worst jailers of journalists, China and Russia, with Turkey and Egypt playing catch-up. Then finally, we will discuss the new candidate entering the 2016 presidential race on the Democratic side in a field that appears to be dominated by Hillary Clinton, and that is the former Virginia Senator Jim Webb. Jacob Halbrun, a senior editor at the National Interest, joins us to discuss his op-ed at the New York Times, The Real Threat to Hillary Clinton, Jim Webb, and the unlikely challenge by Elizabeth Warren compared to the formidable potential of a Jim Webb candidacy. And joining us now is Fritz Ohlhoff, who is a professor in the Department of Philosophy at Western Michigan University. He's the author of What is Nanotechnology and Why Does It Matter? From Science to Ethics. And his forthcoming book is Binary Bullets, The Ethics of Cyber Warfare. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fritz Ohlhoff.
Thanks for having me.
And clearly there's some ethical issues involved in cyber warfare, or cyber vandalism, as the president prefers to describe the to and fro between North Korea and the United States, assuming that the U.S. had something to do with North Korea's internet being shut down for a day, or most of Monday. But when you're dealing with military capabilities, which are so much greater than civilian defenses, as we've learned from the hack of Sony, what are the ethics involved in the sense that it's bloodless, nobody dies, and it's military directed at civilian targets, which in itself seems incredibly unethical. So walk us through this new landscape, if you will.
So for me, I think one of the most important ethical issues is that we try to think through what sorts of responses are justified given cyber attacks. So the Obama administration has said that it will render a response that is proportional to the attack on Sony. And then it's not so clear what that is supposed to mean. So the attack against Sony does tens of millions of dollars of damage. It grabs some movies, it releases some emails. And if we think through what it would mean for a response to be proportional, it's not so clear. So, you know, are we going to release emails of North Korea? Is that somehow supposed to be fair and then it all comes out in the wash? Or more controversially, could a proportional response be comprised of military action? And would it be justified for us to attack either state or civilian targets in North Korea in retaliation? And I think that is a big open question at this stage, is what a proportional response would even mean.
And what are the rules, if any, when a foreign military attacks a commercial entity in another country, as has happened with apparently the North Koreans, this Bureau 121, allegedly the one that's involved in the cyber attack on Sony?
So they're not worked out so well yet. I mean, under the UN Charter, you're allowed to respond with force when subject to a quote armed attack. That's the catchphrase. And what really hasn't been sorted yet is whether these cyber attacks, as it were, rise to the level of an armed attack and therefore could justify the use of military force, or if cyber attacks are somehow different and are not armed attack. And then if they're not armed attack, then under international law, our modes of response would be severely limited. So when the damages are, say, just economic or emotional, it's just not obvious or clear whether military action could be justified. Some people are going to think these are just categorically different kinds of harms and that we can't respond to, say, economic damages with the use of force, whereas other people might think, which is what I think, so long as the economic damages are high enough, then there could be, then physical force could be justified in response.
But surely the fact that nobody dies is a factor, isn't it? War is normally about casualties, and retaliation is usually, you know, about the fact that people have died. As you know, for example, 9/11, 3,000 people in one day.
Sure, but I mean, say that the economic damages, you know, for the Sony attack look to be somewhere in the vicinity of $50 million. And say that human lives are valued by actuarial tables at, you know, somewhere around $5 million. It seems like there might be some sort of an equivalence here, that the attacks are, you know, quite literally worth something like 10 lives. And then, you know, if that reasoning appeals, then this really would be sort of not, this wouldn't be differentiated from an armed attack. It wouldn't be, you know, an attack of 3,000 people. I mean, 10, you know, this equivalence of, say, 10 lives would be comparatively mild. Nevertheless, we would be able to look at these things interchangeably, namely the high economic damages as against lives. So even if people aren't killed, so long as the damages are high enough, we might think that, you know, some sort of physical response could be justified.
So if indeed this attack came from North Korea, which most people think it did, and the retaliation, shutting down North Korea's internet, there's some doubt about it. But the U.S. State Department official did say that we're not going to discuss what we're going to do, and some of it will be visible, some of it will be invisible. And the shutdown of the North Korea's internet happened the day after the president said to CNN that there'd be a proportional response. Some people are attributing it to hackers, but I think it's reasonable to assume that maybe this was a retaliation. But then there was another retaliation by the North Koreans against a South Korean nuclear power plant that's prompted the president of South Korea to go on television and say that this was an extremely dangerous attack that could have had really grave consequences. And we know from meltdowns at Chernobyl and at Fukushima the damage that could be done. So again, you have this confusion over military and civilian. And what are the rules about militaries attacking civilian targets?
So, I mean, under both ethics and international law, we have this principle of discrimination. And the principle of discrimination says that that intentional attacks on civilians are prescribed. You're not allowed to do that. However, collateral damage can sometimes be justified. So if you're attacking a legitimate military target and some of the harm, as it were, spills over to civilians, and that harm is, let's say, foreseen but unintended, that might be okay so long as it's proportional. However, a direct intended attack on a civilian target, like on Sony, let's say, that's wholly out of bounds. You just can't do that under ethics or under international law. And this principle of discrimination is really interesting when you come to cyber warfare, because a lot of the effects of cyber attacks can't be localized to, say, military targets. So if the U.S. responds, let's suppose that the U.S. is responsible for knocking the Korean internet offline for 9 hours or whatever it was. That would be a very indiscriminate attack, because it would have effects not just on the government but on millions of civilians, and that would raise big flags. By the way, you mentioned that the U.S. government might have been responsible for taking North Korea offline, which is true, it might have been, but you also see some of these hacker groups or like Anonymous are already stepping up and taking credit for the denial of service to North Korea. And the reason this is interesting is another big issue with cyber warfare is what's called the attribution problem. So it's hard technically to sort out who is perpetuating some of these attacks sometimes. So a big worry could be if North Korea has its internet knocked offline and then the North Koreans think that the U.S. government did it and say they retaliate against someone like South Korea, but it was, you know, say it was this group of anonymous hackers and the U.S. government didn't do it, you could have all sorts of fallout that would be, unforeseeable and very complicated. So this issue of attribution raises further issues with cyber warfare and how we think through our responses to it.
Well, if it was, say, anonymous or as somebody said, a 15-year-old kid in a Guy Fawkes mask doing this, it doesn't matter because the North Koreans assume that it is the United States. And apparently the North Koreans also assume that the Japanese, the conservative Japanese Prime Minister Abe is in league with Sony to make this movie to defame this young leader of North Korea. So,
right, and then so this raises, I mean, so very quickly you can have substantial issues in escalation, where because a lot of the cyber attacks are happening below the surface or we don't know with precision who perpetuated them, people reach certain conclusions. And then we can get these escalating situations that, I mean, who knows if they're, you know, if they're appropriate or if, you know, if the people that we think are involved don't. I mean, a lot of it trades on rumor, and we're just not sure. So it's, you know, a lot of these decisions are made not in a vacuum, but certainly with very limited information, and that's certainly a striking dynamic of this sort of activity.
Well, apparently, according to a North Korean defector, that Pyongyang has about 1,800 cyber warriors around the world, and they're housed or run out of a secretive group called Bureau 121, and their job is, or their mission is, to conduct cyber attacks against overseas and enemy states. And this raises a question again in terms of ethics. My understanding is that the most advanced nations in cyber warfare, the US, Russia, China, the UK, and Israel. And apparently in Russia, the FSB, the intelligence service, uses brilliant young hackers who commit criminal acts. There's also, I think, a lot of evidence here in the United States that the NSA, the National Security Agency, you know, picks up these teenagers in their bedroom somewhere in the suburbs, you know, that have taken down some commercial entity and caused enormous damage. Then they just rather than send them to jail, they put them to work. So what are the ethics involved in that?
So I think that there's, you know, one of the big hazards of cyber is that we can't always see what's going on, and we don't know what all of the capabilities are of a lot of different countries. So you can contrast this with conventional warfare. So if a country sort of, you know, sends off a military deployment, I mean, everyone knows what's going on. And, you know, there's special ops, you know, forces and, you know, they're more invisible, but at least conventional military forces, everyone knows where these people are and how many there are. And these, you know, there's monitors and people know this sort of stuff, but cyber, we don't know. And it's a big disanalogy, and structurally the situation is very different. Also, in cyber, there's a tremendous amount of asymmetry, and you know, say a country like North Korea that militarily might be comparatively weak, say against the U.S., nevertheless has tremendous capacity vis-a-vis its cyber infrastructure. You know, like as we see that North Korea can do to Sony. So in a lot of ways, the cyber realm levels the playing field, right, in favor of some of these, militarily weaker countries and empowers them. And then that's certainly it's a worry, because then these, you know, a rogue state can do more stuff than it could with conventional military forces. Of course, it could also resort to terrorism, which is another big mode of asymmetric warfare. But the cyber realm really turns a lot of these traditional dynamics on their head.
So, what then is the are the rules of the road in this new landscape that we don't know much about? It would seem to me, just off the top of my head, the one thing that appears to be happening here, given that North Korea probably its capabilities militarily are way down the list of those that I just mentioned, the top countries with the most mature cyber warfare capabilities are the U.S., Russia, China, the U.K., and Israel. So what seems to be happening is that there's a kind of mutually assured destruction going on, that we only know of the cyber attacks that the Russians conducted against the Baltic states. They were unattributed, but most people think they came from Russia. And my understanding is that every day there are cyber attacks, thousands of them, in the civilian area. Are the military people involved in any of this, or are they just keeping their powder dry? Because the more infrastructure you have, like the United States is probably the most vulnerable country in the world, because it depends so much upon its infrastructure, and probably the least vulnerable country in the world is North Korea.
Right. So, and you mentioned this earlier, there's a distinction between the civilian and the military. So the U.S. has a lot of technical expertise vis-a-vis its cyber campaigns. On the other hand, you have a bunch of small companies or even individuals making personal websites, putting stuff up. There's no coordinated defense, for those. So civilian targets can end up highly vulnerable, while at the same time, the military maintains tremendous capability. So a big worry is that these reports come out that say there's tens of thousands of cyber attacks against U.S. targets every day. Obviously, some of those are going to be against military, but a lot of them are far more basic than that: stealing passwords, identity theft, bank login information, those sorts of things. And it's very hard for the U.S. to stand up and sort of coordinate a response to these far more pedestrian attacks. Obviously, if the Pentagon's going to get hacked, the U.S. is going to figure that out and have a very sophisticated strategy. But in terms of protecting just e-commerce, it's very hard, particularly if you have countries like North Korea that have, or in China that have, a lot of interest in targeting these sorts of structures.
So given that there's tens of thousands of cyber attacks per day on a constant basis, and we continually hear about Target and these big companies losing thousands, hundreds of thousands of credit card and social security data on customers, presumably, yep, that which then could be used to loot their bank accounts, and this apparently happens on a daily basis. And I don't know, maybe you have some figures on the cost of criminality on the internet, but it's got to be in the billions.
Yeah, so Richard Clark, an important figure in this debate, wrote a book, and he said it's tens of billions of dollars a year, mostly siphoned off from e-commerce, and a lot of that is going. The majority of that is siphoned off over to China.
So China the fingerprints then would be on the military, because they have another unit that apparently conducts their stuff. Or is this?
I don't think for the e-commerce hacking. I don't think there are allegations that that's necessarily the Chinese military, as opposed to individual hackers. I don't know, but I'm not impugning the Chinese military.
Right, but China is a country that really does control its internet, just as Russia is moving to totally control their internet. And in fact, there's a lot of upset that Facebook in Russia took down a page of an opposition candidate who wanted to have a rally, and Facebook took down his page.
Yeah, that's right. And China's gotten into all sorts of interesting issues with internet. So whereas some of the search engines, Google and Yahoo, have had issues, mm-hmm, and have pulled out or been blocked. So the state-controlled internet is certainly raises issues.
Well, it raises the issue in my mind, is that the Chinese authorities would know who the hackers are. So if you know who your hackers are, you could either put them in jail or put them to work. So that was my assumption. So just in closing, Fritz Ahlhoff, what is the line then ethically between, say, Anonymous, who does a hacking job for ideological reasons, you know, against, say, a corporation that's done something bad, or, you know, just the general run-of-the-mill criminal hacker?
So I think that one of the biggest distinction for me is whether it's state-sponsored or civilian. And if it's state-sponsored, then we're kicked into all sorts of different legal regimes, right, under, say, use of force and armed attack, whereas if it's civilian, then we're talking about criminal prosecution as opposed to military action. So, you know, if you have civilian against civilian, which I think that's what, you know, a lot of this is, then that would be prosecuted through criminal courts. But when you have, say, a state attack, either a state or a civilian, as we have in the North Korea case, then that raises a specter of military intervention and armed attack. And I think that's a significant issue and a, you know, very provocative one.
Well, Fritz Ahlhoff, I thank you very much for joining us here today. And, you know, obviously we need to visit this subject more often and try and get a handle on it, because it's a whole new frontier, and it looks like it's going to be a frontier of warfare that's going to grow and become more dangerous and more prevalent.
Well, Ian, thanks for inviting me. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
We'll take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the new annual report from the Committee to Protect Journalists. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Carlos Loria, who's the Senior Americas Program Coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists, where he serves as Chief Strategist and Spokesperson on press freedom issues in the Americas. He monitors and documents press freedom violations in Latin America and has led missions to Mexico, Colombia, Guatemala, Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Haiti, Brazil, El Salvador, and Argentina. He serves on the board of the Maria Moores Cabot Award for Excellence in Latin American Journalism, which was sponsored by the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carlos Loria.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Ian, and thanks for your interest in CBJ's work.
And the CBJ, the Committee to Protect Journalists, have just issued a special report on the number of journalists killed, and the rate of journalists killed in 2014, particularly in the Middle East, has gone up considerably. In total, at least 60 journalists were killed globally in 2014 in relation to their work, compared to 70 who died in 2013. So this has been a bad year for those covering the news.
Definitely. It's been, in fact, a very bad few years for the press. The total numbers of journalists killed in direct relation with the work and this year shows the sustained level of risk of journalists, you know, in the past 3 years. It has been the most deadly 3 years period CPJ has recorded. As you said, the Middle East was particularly bad for journalists. Almost half of those killed this year died in the Middle East. And of those, almost 40% died in combat or crossfire. One of the aspects of this analysis of our killed census, which was released today, is that there is a high proportion of international journalists in the tally, in the 2014 tally, which reflects at the same time the difficult nature of covering conflict zones, in which we have this year many Western journalists being deliberately targeted.
And of that, of course, was the case of Anja Niedinghaus, a German photographer for the Associated Press, who was shot dead by an Afghan policeman while covering the elections. And of course, we all saw the execution on television of the U.S. freelance journalist James Foley, executed by members of the so-called Islamic State. And that, of course, was a trauma for the whole world, and it was followed by the execution of Stephen Sotloff as well.
Yeah.
So how has this affected coverage, the fact that is there a direct relationship between the risks the journalists take and the number that killed and the quality of coverage? Has it deterred them in any way?
Well, I mean, there is an effect, clearly. And, you know, the fact that this journalist are going into areas where just, you know, a few people are daring to go, you know, it's gives you the sense of, you know, the chill that this can pose to other people thinking of going to these areas. But, you know, also important in the analysis of this killed data, Ian, is the fact that despite the risks to Western journalists working in conflict zones, as it has happened in the past, the big majority of reporters under threat for the work continue to be local. And Syria, for example, which is, again, the leading place for, you know, the worst place for journalists in 2014, you know, in this country, according to CPJ estimates, there are around 30 journalists currently missing, many of whom are believed to be held by the Islamic State, and most of them are local. So this is something really important. But, you know, it's clearly that in this particular year, risks for international journalists have been higher.
And again, I'm speaking with Carlos Loria, who's a senior Americas program coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists. And we're talking about the report that just came out today by the Committee to Protect Journalists on the death toll of journalists in 2014, where almost half the journalists killed in 2014 died in the Middle East. But it also says, this report, that more than 40% of the journalists killed in 2014 were targeted for murder. About 31% of journalists murdered reported receiving threats before they were murdered. So that's a different thing from being caught in the crossfire in combat. And nowadays, of course, combat is so much more dangerous because these wars tend to be civil wars and with the irregulars on both sides, where, you know, not that previous wars weren't dangerous, but these wars today seem to be a lot more dangerous than they used to be.
Yeah, and this is a very alarming pattern in the in the analysis of this kill data, because, you know, a big percentage of those journalists that were targeted for murder received threats prior to their being to be killed. So, you know, this gives you a sense of, you know, the fact that these people were threatened previously, were killed. There was very little, almost none, that was done in terms of providing protection for these journalists after they were threatened. It's clearly that, in many of these cases, journalists are threatened previously, but, this can help, some of these reporters to receive protection and avoid those kind of consequences. It doesn't happen. In most cases, these journalists receive threats and then, they are killed. And this talks about, the lack of justice and impunity that surrounds most of these killings, which clearly aggravates the issue. In many of these countries where journalists are killed, justice systems are incapable or unwilling to provide justice, to solve these cases, to prosecute those responsible. And this clearly aggravates the situation.
So in terms of the Americas, the area that you monitor, Carlos Loria, for the Committee to Protect Journalists, Mexico has been pretty dangerous for journalists. And I imagine a lot of the ones that were targeted for murder and warned before they were murdered, that probably happened in Mexico, or at least some of it.
Definitely. That's kind of a pattern in Mexico where, more than 50 journalists have been killed or disappeared in a period of 7 years. This is one of the worst countries for journalists in the Americas and one of the worst in the world. Numbers are eloquent enough, but the context in which this killings takes place is really alarming, because there are regions in Mexico, widespread throughout the countries, where the criminal networks are in control of territory, and they determine what journalists can cover or what they cannot cover. There are areas in Mexico where there's a complete information vacuum, where journalists are not able to cover anything related to crime, corruption, or human rights abuses, because they will be targeted. So there's many communities that are completely uninformed on what's going on many of the issues that affect the daily lives of people there. So this is not a press freedom issue. This is a much bigger issue, an issue that goes as affecting fundamental human rights of Mexicans, right to freedom of expression, right to access to information, and it's clearly inhibiting the possibility of Mexicans to engage in a discussion, right, in a public debate about the issues that are affecting their daily lives. And, clearly an issue that is, damaging democratic stability, no question about it. But also this year, we found that at least three journalists were killed in Paraguay. The first time since 2007, the CPJ confirmed a press-related death in that country. Two of the journalists were radio hosts. In one case, journalist was Pablo Medina was a correspondent of the largest circulation daily ABC Color. And, according to investigators, a local mayor is a suspected mastermind of this crime. He's now a fugitive of the justice. Reports are saying that he fled to Brazil. And, you know, this can tell you, the journalist was investigating, looking into drug trafficking issues and, you know, the links between drug trafficking and the local government when he was killed.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Carlos Loria, the report from the Committee to Protect Journalists on those killed, a record number killed this year, also identified 220 journalists in jail around the world. And the worst offender for jailing journalists is China, followed by Iran, then Eritrea, Ethiopia, Vietnam, Egypt, Syria, Burma, Azerbaijan, and Turkey. And things, of course, are ramping up in Turkey. So China, you know, that's a lot of these countries seem to be turning back the clock. China under a more authoritarian leadership, Egypt under a more authoritarian leadership, and Turkey. So trends aren't looking good, right, for jailing journalists?
No, they aren't looking good. You know, this daily imprisoned journalists for the work marks the second highest number of journalists in jail since CPJ began taking an annual census of imprisoned journalists in 1990. And as you said, highlights a resurgence of authoritarian governments in countries such as China, Ethiopia also, Burma and Egypt. And in many of these cases, countries are using archaic anti-state charges for imprisonment of journalists, bloggers, editors, and photographers.
Well, Carlos Loria, I thank you very much for joining us here today, and have a happy Christmas and a great new year.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, Ian, and I hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Carlos Loria, who's a Senior Americas Program Coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists. We're going to take a brief station break, Mac, looking into the new Democratic candidate for the presidency in 2016, Senator Jim Webb. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jacob Heilbrun, who's a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the LA Times, a senior editor at The New Republic, and a Japan Society Fellow. He has an op-ed at The New York Times, The Real Threat to Hillary Clinton, Jim Webb. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacob Heilbrun.
Thank you, Ian.
And Jim Webb, of course, a Vietnam vet, a former senator from Virginia. Let me start with, why did he leave the Senate, Jacob? Is there any story there apart from the fact that he just got sick of Washington politics?
I think he was bored with it, and he's someone who's always sought out new challenges. So he did what politicians don't usually do, and he quit while he was ahead.
So there was no baggage, no scandals, no subtext now. This guy's squeaky clean in terms of a potential candidate?
Yeah. I mean, look, he has baggage that's well known. For the Democrats, he's against gun control. He wrote against having women serving in the armed forces in 1979 in Washingtonian magazine. And he has stuck up for the Southern Confederacy. So those are all red flags for Democrats, obviously.
Well, the latter would be, but to what extent did he? I mean, he's not an atavist, is he? He's not.
No. I'm just saying that these are things that could be thrown at him in a primary.
Uh-huh.
they would try to depict him as anti-woman and as a redneck and so forth. That would be that's what the Clinton campaign would attempt to do. The plus side for Webb is he does come from a hardscrabble background. He espouses both economic populism and a non-interventionist foreign policy. And he has a long and successful record in public life, as well as being a war hero. So he addresses many of the weaknesses that Democrats have had in the past.
And he's, of course, a successful novelist. You, being a writer, Jacob, you know that your words live on.
Tom Wolfe said he wrote the best Vietnam-era novel ever. Mm-hmm. And I have read his memoirs, and they're very skillfully crafted. Mm-hmm. Eloquent, direct, and forceful as a public speaker. To be honest, I think he could tie Hillary up in knots in a debate.
So would he? The reason I asked about his novels is: are there any words that come back to haunt him?
No, I don't think so. I mean, he gave an honest depiction of what the war was like in Vietnam, and I don't think that there's anything in there that would cause him problems.
So how far along is he? He's got an exploratory committee, right? Is that where we stand in terms of the possible candidacy?
He stuck a toe into the water. His biggest obstacle, obviously, would be fundraising against the Clinton machine. He's got to somehow try and emulate the Obama model, where you have grassroots popularity. And in his exploratory committee announcement, it was done against a very plain backdrop, and a lot of the political experts were scoffing at it. But it may well have been deliberate. He is the anti-establishment candidate. He's the Democratic Party's version of a Tea Party candidate.
Right. Well, he does sound in many ways a lot like Rand Paul, certainly in his non-interventionist foreign policy outlook.
I don't think he's that far from Rand Paul, and frankly, in economic policy, he's not all that far from Elizabeth Warren. He's opposed to free trade. He rails against Wall Street banks and bailouts. He did vote for Obamacare. He is someone who believes that the working class in America has been shafted.
Well, that would be, I think, a powerful message. I was just speaking with Thomas Ferguson yesterday, who'd done an analysis of the last election. And, you know, we have this trend in American politics where fewer and fewer people are voting and more money's pouring in. And he makes the connection that the reason that we had the lowest turnout, perhaps even in history, in 36% in this last midterm, and most of the people who didn't show up were Democrats and working people, is that they're just disgusted. They're disgusted with the Democrats and the Republicans. So I think anybody that could champion what we could call the new silent majority surely has a good chance.
That is what Webb would attempt to do. But he has a chance. Whether he has a good chance is another question. You do have the Clinton money machine. However, it comes down also to how good and viable a candidate is Hillary Clinton in the end. She does not possess the political skills of her husband. She's somewhat stiff and wooden. And you add to that, she's not fresh or new. Webb would be able to capitalize on the outsider who is determined to clean up Washington. And he has a pretty novel message that you would think would appeal to many voters, particularly in the Iowa and New Hampshire primaries, because he's going to be the most anti-war candidate of anyone. But at the same time, he has served in combat, and he was Secretary of the Navy during the Reagan administration. You're not going to be able to depict him as a weakling or someone who's an isolationist.
And, of course, the unreal threat, if you will, is Elizabeth Warren, who progressives are clamoring for, she continually says she's not running, and I frankly believe her. Do you think she's running or will run?
I think, from what I've heard, it's unlikely it's possible she might challenge Hillary, but I've been told that she would like to be Attorney General in a Clinton administration.
So if Webb runs, what's the threshold for him getting in the debates? Because I've spoken a number of times to Bernie Sanders about him getting in the debates, and he would like to get in the debates, but he doesn't want to be a spoiler and you know, do what Ralph Nader did in Florida in 2000 and help elect a right-wing Republican. So I don't know how Bernie's going to navigate that. You know, the best chance, I think, would be for a kind of groundswell petition to demand that he gets on the Democratic debates. But those debates are controlled by the party machines, aren't they?
And yeah. Well, if they can show that they have serious backing, then they would be in the debates. And I would be surprised if Webb did not pass that threshold. This could be a much more tumultuous primary than people are anticipating.
Right. It won't be a coronation of Hillary. And that
I think that a lot of people have lingering doubts about Hillary Clinton's abilities as a campaigner, and they were ruthlessly exposed by Barack Obama in 2008.
Right,
has there been any sign that she has radically improved? Not on her book tour.
Well, but I think it comes down to, you know, executive decisions. I mean, you know, I think, for example, the first executive decision that Al Gore took was to to put Lieberman on the ticket. The second decision he took was to concede an election that he'd won. You know, and Hillary, when she was running, her first executive decisions, as far as I could tell, was to choose a really terrible campaign manager.
Yeah.
I mean, doesn't this go to their judgment?
Yes, because obviously, I mean, it's a truism that the campaign is the first test of your ability to govern as president.
Right. Well, presumably she's learned something, but who makes these decisions? Who chose the what was his name? Mark somebody?
Mark Penn.
Yeah, Mark Penn last time. Was that, did Bill Foyce? She's
still close to Mark Penn.
She is still close to him?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, you know, Jacob, we've just seen the worst of Democratic Party operatives in 2014. They have to be the most brain-dead political operatives. I mean, Karl Rove looks like a genius compared to them. I mean, look what happened to the Alison Grimes down in Kentucky, running against Mitch McConnell, who she refused to even admit she had anything to do with Obama. It was scared to death to take advantage of Obamacare, which is so damn popular in the state, that Mitch McConnell ran on the lie that he would get rid of Obamacare, but not in the state of Kentucky.
Right.
What's wrong with these people? I mean, you can blame the candidate, but also it does seem that the Democratic Party's bench of political operatives are absolutely out to lunch.
Well, I think Hillary Clinton is already being put on notice that this is going to be a rougher terrain than she had anticipated. The question is how she'll be able to navigate it.
Right.
She does have challengers.
Right, but assuming that who you pick matters, is there, just to answer my question, do you think that there's any talent in the Democratic Party in terms of, you know, Carville and company are all sort of consultants now to various other countries? Who's around that you think could run a competitive campaign?
You know, it's a good question because a lot of them are old now. And the people in the Obama campaign are not going to... She's really relying on an older cast. And don't forget that Bill Clinton is really going to be, in the end, the main campaign manager.
Well, that's, you know, not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, he's still incredibly popular. I think if Al Gore had used Bill Clinton in his campaign, he would have won. I mean, it was crazy.
Yeah.
That he...
Well, the question with Bill Clinton will be whether he tends to be very defensive of her, and he did not do well against Obama. If you recall, he brought up the race angle.
Right.
And it blew up in his own face.
Right.
And the question for voters will be, again, do they want Bill Clinton back in the White House? There are all sorts of And let's face it, in the Bill Clinton era was the enabling of the Wall Street and of the financial community. I mean, the 90s was the era when the Democratic Party went down this road. Now, Hillary Clinton's message is she's been very friendly to Wall Street, and she's pursued a hawkish foreign policy. So her record is quite opposed to the progressive direction of the party right now. The party is moving to the left. She does not represent that in her past, in her stance.
Well, but in effect, I think what you're arguing in your New York Times piece, Jacob Abram, the real threat to Hillary Clinton, Jim Webb, is that he doesn't have to pander to the right like Hillary does by being so hawkish. He's got the credentials as a former Reagan administration Secretary of the Navy, a Vietnam veteran. And in American culture, veterans are the only people that can really have a strong anti-war stance. I mean, you know, unfortunately, the left in this country is not taken seriously. And so, in other words, you have an authentic guy who's actually a dove as opposed to a phony hawk.
Right. Well, Webb actually means what he says.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
He does pose a problem for Clinton there. I also think it's not just that he also can't be depicted as weak on foreign policy, and he will have crossover appeal to Republicans as well. So he's a far more interesting candidate than Hillary Clinton is. She's a packaged candidate who is constantly calibrating or attempting to calibrate what will sell best in the election. But unfortunately, my sense is that her calibrations are often not wise ones. And I suppose, if at all, we'll find out what Hillary Clinton actually stands for, if she does stand for any coherent ideology in this primary.
Well, I remember meeting Jim Webb a long time ago and being impressed by the guy, but what is your sense of how he is going to appear on the national scene? Already you're saying he's getting criticism for doing a sort of low-key, you know, toe-in-the-water announcement. He did campaign in his son's Iraq War combat boots and defeated a very conservative Republican in Virginia. Virginia, of course, ironically, the new governor of Virginia is the Clinton money man, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So what's your sense of how he's going to campaign? Is he going to be, you know, do something along the lines of the combat boots, a more guerrilla campaign, shall we say?
Yeah, I think it's going to be very stripped down, very basic, attempt to have a grassroots campaign as someone who understands Washington, but also is not captive to it, and who has, you know, it's interesting, like Obama, he's lived abroad, too. So I think he sees America with kind of a double vision.
Where did he live?
He lived in Britain.
For how long? I mean,
several years.
Was that when he was researching the book on the Anglo-Saxon?
No, it was as a child. He was a military brat.
So. Oh, I see.
And he was there in the early 50s, and he saw the destruction of World War II, which left a deep impression on him. Mm-hmm. And even there in his memoirs, he says Britain was bled out, and they had a much keener appreciation of the cost of war than Americans ever have.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's obviously true, and that's why 9/11 was so traumatic for America. They've been...
Yeah, I mean, Webb is someone who believes in the greatness of America and in American power. At the same time, however, he's not a jingoist.
Mm-hmm. And I guess by implication, you're saying that Hillary's going to be, because she's always a cheerleader.
Well, she's made the calculation that she started shifting to the right, in the past, even further in the past 6 months, and away from Obama, reckoning that she had the primary wrapped up and that she would insulate herself from Republican charges of being soft.
Mm-hmm.
And her whole record is Secretary of State, pro-Libya, pro-intervention in Syria, all of those things, again, could cause her problems in the primary. Webb was, you know, quite fervently opposed to both the Iraq War and to the Libyan venture of 2011.
Well, I think that being opposed to the Iraq War is definitely a badge of honor, and it's one that Obama's milked, even though he was a sort of political nobody when he opposed the war. But this guy was in the Senate, right, when he opposed the war?
Well, he wasn't in the Senate during the Iraq War, but he was quite prominent. I mean, right. he went into the pages of the Washington Post and declared, do we want to be there for 35 years? I mean, he was no ifs, ands, or buts. He was breaking ranks by taking that position. I think it was pretty courageous.
And he got elected, basically.
That's correct, in 2006.
Right. So just in closing then, Jacob Harbron, what do you think is going to happen with your op-ed? It's the first time I heard about Jim Webb running, and I'm sure that's probably the case with most people. So it's kind of under the radar. But, you know, Rand Paul is getting so much print. He, you know, so is it possible that Democrats are going to wake up and say, hey, you know, because that's one of the things that I find extraordinary about liberals is how much they're beguiled by Rand Paul and how they love the fact that he's anti-war and pro-marijuana, but they forget the fact that he wants to get rid of the government altogether and have the Koch brothers run America, you know? So this...
Well, he is something new in the Republican Party, and he has the potential to create a civil war in the Republican Party. I think a lot of his stance are refreshing. He's also for prison reform, and I mean, I think he does say sensible things.
Oh, there's no question, but I'm saying, but he's not a Democrat. He's not a liberal.
He's a true conservative.
And liberals think he is. But they have somebody that they can go to now who's authentic and who's really on their side, particularly on domestic economic issues, where Rand Paul is out in right-wing loony land.
Yeah, Webb should... my gut sense is that Webb will appeal to many Democrats, that they may rethink the supposed automatic allegiance to Hillary Clinton. Be better for the party, frankly, to have a real battle anyway.
It certainly will be better for the television watcher, and I think, as you implied, it's likely that the Democratic primaries will get a lot of airtime as the Republican ones did with Mitt Romney et al.
Yeah. Well, we don't have a sitting president.
That's right.
Either.
Sure. Well, I thank you for joining us, Jacob Harbron, and have a very happy Christmas and a prosperous New Year.
Thanks, Ian. Same to you.
Particularly to somebody that used to be with the New Republic.
Well, that was years ago.
I know. But I feel for all those out-of-work journalists.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, thank you again, Jacob.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Jacob Harbron, who is a senior editor at The National Interest and the author of They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Previously, he was an editorial writer for the LA Times, a senior editor at the New Republic, and a Japan Society fellow. He has an op-ed at the New York Times, The Real Threat to Hillary Clinton, Jim Webb. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.